Thank you both. Those are really interesting papers, and I think we're probably going to find some points of contact as we go along. So why don't we open up the floor to questions? I wonder if it would be better to move a couple of chairs around and move you all up here. I don't want to leave you standing up too long, but.
Movable chairs. The chairs are immovable.
They are movable.
Here are two movable chairs.
I can direct traffic from over here. So.
Questions for both. The first one, you, I realize that your study is a very nice theoretical analysis of the national orders, legal orders. But I don't think I perceived anything exactly in your paper that as to whether this is actually a good thing, either from any perspective, whether it be moral or whatever.
Yeah, that's sort of strange for a law professor, but you're right, right? I don't try to say, and I don't think you can say that, you know, this is abstractly a good thing or a negative thing. One has to break it down into different types of aspects. I mean, it certainly has normative implications, right? So the way transnational legal orders operate provide different opportunities at the national level and constraints at the national level. There may be some areas of law where you think this is a good thing, right? So that you can harm, say, different forms of human rights law, social welfare law, depending on your politics, right? You might find, and there are going to be actors who find that, yes, this provides new opportunities, new linkages outside of the state itself in order to try to transform the state. There's going to be other areas where, depending on your politics, you're going to have a very different view in terms of the Financial Action Task Force is often critiqued, right, as being sort of a U.S. ploy to address, to harness others to try to address U.S. aims, basically the war on terror and the war on drugs. And it's our, you know, local policies and our foreign policies which drive much of this. And that's actually the sort of starting point, I think, for the Brazilian, the study by the Brazilian. But what was really fascinating was how she herself normatively sort of changed her views during the project. This is not in the paper so much as talking to her, because Brazil has real issues with respect to money laundering in terms of corruption of officials and sort of the shadow state of organized crime. And so they really latched on to the leverage and the resources provided at the transnational level for their own local purposes. So for there, it can be quite positive. Certainly in South Africa, the competition law norms, you can, so much of this, again, it's usually US and European models that are taken. Sometimes in the competition law model, they really conflict. They agree in some areas, such as price fixing, but in terms of sort of abuse of dominant positions, they take quite different views here in the United States. South Africa, it was really interesting as they had their own social histories and their own political context and how they could use this, these devices. And it actually, competition laws become, the Competition Commission in South Africa has been quite powerful to it because they had a real problem with respect to concentration of resource extraction industries and others. Which they've been trying to break up. And so that, and you actually, you have a different, because of the history of South Africa, you have a different interaction between large capital and the government, which we don't see in most other countries. And so there was, that created real opportunities for them. They took it quite seriously. So I think it depends. There's no normative position as to whether or not transnational law is a good thing or a bad thing. It just exists, right? And then the question is, what do you do with it?
If I can jump up in here just with a follow-up question, so I think this comes right back to the same point. Your project is, it sounds to me, a descriptive project, not a prescriptive project.
Yes.
That's, you're trying to say, this is what goes on.
It has prescriptive implications.
Exactly.
Yes,
yeah.
But it itself is not a prescriptive project. So, for instance, co-writing in the U.S. law schools, or this is purely prescriptive, right? That we are actors, activists, and our role is to facilitate the compliance and the internalization, to use his term, of international law norms, right? I put into question, is international law a good or a bad thing? Not necessarily, it depends.
Well, but okay, you did sort of, I think, at one point touch on the idea of colonialism.
Yes.
This is effectively neocolonialism.
Yeah, so one can, so you see, you could see many on the left critiquing of this, world systems theory, others sort of has a blade, that this is a form of hegemony, a new form of hegemony, but that these norms typically are U.S. European norms. But this, I think that once you go into the local context, you see that that's much too simplified and structural of a position, that actually there's lots of conflicts at the national level, and there are people who want to try to use these norms for their own purposes. So if you look at the South African Constitution, it brings in all sorts of international human rights, right, into the Constitution itself, which play out in new ways, which then feed back into our conception, especially of social rights, where the major cases in terms of access to water, access, land redistribution, health, the right to health. These are being played out in a South African context, but those norms come out of UN documents and human rights treaties.
No. Thanks, Greg, for your view. It seems to me you have focalized on this idea of top-down formation of international law and its implementation. So it's sort of international actors looking at harmonizing or persuading national levels or regional levels to go better. For example, you call to the International Work, the Convention on Labor Conditions or Public Health or Child's Rights. It seems to me that the last 30 years, probably with globalization and financialization, that has introduced some new elements you have to take into account. And because, so if you look at legal cases, you have increasingly some struggle between corporations, for example, in national states, appealing to international law to defend some property rights or to prevent or force national states to do something. So even in the context of law and development, you have this kind of new kind of conflicts who show in a way a different way of shaping and utilizing this international order in a way. And in a very broad sense, this international order actually is a sort of disorder at the same time. You experience worlds beyond the previous legal order. Actually, we have established for worlds. It's strange to say that, but in a way we try to regulate the interaction between states, and we gave up it in the last 15 years or so. And so, and some reaction of this process occurs. So let me raise a field I know quite well, the accounting regulation, for example. So you try to have a movement between towards harmonization and after to convergence to a sort of Anglo-American system. At the same time, you have some reactions. So some national reaction, states at the present refusing to adopt these international standards, and tentatively regional agreement between, for example, China, Japan, and Korea, probably facing the pressure from the international level. So try to figure out this bottom-up side of the process, probably to integrate both the light side and the dark side of. So go ahead with this idea of process, but try to broaden the framework of analysis.
I mean, I agree with you, and we try to address both these top-down and bottom-up. And so that's, we attempt to do that. One has a particular frame, right, which is always going to shape where one casts one's lens. And so we critique, I mean, the paper explicitly critiques sort of this vision of a transnational legal order as a given starting point, right? But most of it, most of the empirical work really focuses on the reception and then the feedback in terms of these international norms, right? Although they give some historical background in terms of how they're constructed in the first place. One of the last sections on recursivity talks about, on the one hand, where do these norms come from, which involves a lot of competition, right? And then how they're received, and then how does this reception feed back into the reevaluation of the norms themselves in a constant process. In terms of different areas, if anybody's interested, I'm doing a follow-up project with a book project with just conceptualized it to get a grant with Terry Halliday, which tries to look at the variation in transnational legal orders. So some of them, involve a lot of disorder, right? And we try to look at the way the grant proposal written is to look at the degree of settlement of the transnational legal norm, right? And the degree of competition between different international institutions with respect to the international norm, and how to look at different functional areas which fall basically within a quad along these two dimensions, and what sort of normative implications that has, in particular for national governance. So people are interested, let me know.
I do have a question on tax, but I thought I would ask a follow-up on the transnational law. And I was just wondering, I didn't see your thoughts on the development of these norms and some of the problems that arise because of global competition and the race to the bottom, that concept.
We do talk about the potential for race at the bottom, race at the top. My own view is that it's going to depend on the issue area. So you can't speak of a global race to the top and everything, or a race to the bottom. But I think most of the evidence actually shows that we don't have a race to the bottom. I mean, that's my own view in many of these different areas. And so that you actually do see different forms of regulation, but regulation taking place. So that even if So the state may devolve, there's lots of privatization, it devolves certain activities, and you may see, the development model of East Asia, right, where the state is bureaucracy for making calling all the shots, right, that has been recast, and so that in many ways you see more independent agencies functioning, you see a role of courts, you see other actors, playing a more of a role, but I don't see that you see necessarily a race to laxity of regulations. So.
How about a choice of multinational corporations to incorporate different places or organize in different places?
What's driving so much of the construction of transnational law, of course, is the mismatch between the regulatory framework, which remains at the national level, and global corporations being able to pick and choose their location. So this drives, right, the transnational network, transgovernmental networks, international institutions, et cetera, that's the great story, is that I'm doing another piece just on the empirical study of international law, and you see both in the flagship journals in political science and in sociology, you see this fivefold increase in papers that they're publishing on law, right, international law and transnational law. And that's just a reflection of what's taking place, right? But that mismatch is is a reality. And so, yes, you have these business orders which either can play off of states or they create their own transnational legal orders, which we also, one can also see, right, in terms of how to harmonize or create common regulations. And that's all, there's a lot of competition taking place because there's different business norms which are being used. There's also rival ones by NGOs, et cetera.
Yeah, and also there's a whole thing about, the greenwashing or trying to appear and, all that. Kind
with BP and others, right, with their fancy flower, yeah.
I just wanted to ask, to kind of shift towards the women's paper. When you were sort of finishing, you're talking about different tax systems seem to work better for different kinds of effects. And I wonder if there's a way we can think about how something like a redistributive tax might actually work towards the regulatory system. So for example, when you were talking about why income taxes don't work well for getting people to buy health care, part of the problem is that in the United States you have just sort of massive degrees of social inequality. So if you actually use the income tax structure to sort of adjust the structure of social inequality, would that then play into how the tax, other taxes could be used as part of a regulatory system? So how these different effects might actually all be part of some sort of broader conception of what tax and regulation might look like.
Yeah, no, I think that's great. I mean, that's exactly the problem, of course, that every policy that you adopt has implications for other policies. What I was trying to do, and maybe it's easier done conceptually than otherwise, but it does have some real life implications, is to try to see if we can focus on one goal at a time. And even if it is true that everything that we do has impacts on everything else, I think it's important to set our mind to say that, for example, you know, the main role of the income tax is to achieve redistribution. And if you look at it that way, that's not how it's treated in the United States, of course, and it's also not how it's treated in a lot of developing countries because they can't really do it. But in a lot of other OECD member countries, it does have that effect. And even in the U.S., I mean, the income tax is hugely redistributive. I mean, it's paid primarily by the rich. And if you focus on that, then you can maybe devise some corollaries that flow from that, both in terms of what you want to achieve with other mechanisms and in terms of what you don't want to achieve. And I think a lot of the problems that we have result from our attempt to use taxes in ways that they're not really meant to be used. And you're right, to the extent that the problem is inequality, as you say, if you achieve redistribution via the income tax, you mitigate that. And then, for example, you can worry less about the regressivity of the VAT, which is one of the main arguments that is always used why we shouldn't have a VAT, or is that it's regressive, and so on. So I think that's a very good suggestion.
Did you have a question? Oh, okay.
All right. Yeah, I was fascinated by your paper because I'm not a lawyer, but I'm a CPA. So I know quite a bit about taxes, although about 20 years ago I said I'm not going to study taxes anymore because it's completely ridiculous. The whole tax system in the United States is completely ridiculous. But anyway, and you may know that the AICPA comes out every year with recommendations to simplify the tax system. And Congress completely ignores it. And I think that's the primary problem, is because, you know, you could be a law professor and you could talk about the ideal tax systems and what the purposes are and all of that, and yet the tax system is part of the democratic legislative process. So, I mean, ideally we should take it out of the democratic legislative process, not, you know, taxes is too important to be left to the legislators. Administered by people like law professors who know more what they're doing than legislators. Because every time a tax bill passes, it's got all those three things, distributive, regulation, and revenue raising, all mixed in. I'll just give you an example. The other day I got a ticket, a fine, because I forgot to have my car inspected. It's fairly large, $75. Now what is that? Revenue raising, regulation, redistributive. It's a tax. And there's so many. In France, they have different words for the word tax. You know, they have impôt, they have tax. I think there's some other words as well. And they differentiate between what they are, the meaning. Maybe we should have, you know, we should have a word that means distributive, and another word that means revenue raising, and another word that means
regulation.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right, unfortunately. There's no question that you're right in practice. And in fact, it's worse than that because we use the terminology deliberately in order to achieve political ends and to hide what's really being done. So the bank tax is called a fee,
yes.
And the health care fine really is called a tax for constitutional reasons and so on and so forth. So it all depends on the and cap and trade is not called a tax at all, even though of course the opponents do call it a tax, I think correctly so. But I think that you're right. I mean, we're not going to get clarity on this as a practical matter anytime soon. But I think conceptually it's helpful to try to draw these divisions and then, you know, point out to legislators that maybe they are trying to achieve too much, you know, three birds with one stone.
Well, I got a question for Greg, but I have a point of information. When you were talking about the evolution of thinking about tax expenditures, uh-huh. I had no clue what a consistent baseline might be. Is that theoretical or is that administrative and bureaucratic?
No, the theory is what's called the Hague-Simons definition of income, which is this was something that was developed already in the 30s, and the notion is, since we have an income tax, income is defined as the sum of consumption plus savings. So whatever we consume in a given year plus the increase in our wealth from the beginning of the year to the next year, that's income, and that we should try to reach all of that. So that was Searle's idea to define the baseline to begin with. The problem is that from the beginning this wasn't how it was done. So for example, we have in our tax system what's called the realization principle, which means that we don't actually tax the increase in the value of your house until you sell it, or even stocks and bonds and stuff like that. Most academics generally don't like that particularly, but that has never been, as a political matter, part of the tax expenditure bracket. The lower rate that we have for capital gains, that we usually have for capital gains, is not part of the tax expenditure bracket because, it's all a question of how you define the baseline. So the theory of it is reasonably clear, but the practicalities have always been murky, and the argument of the opponents has always been, and this was what was essentially implemented by Kleinbart 2 years ago and then reversed when he left, that there should be no theory, that we should only look at when Congress says a general rule. The same thing, by the way, came up in the context of WTO law when they were looking at the WTO has this concept of an export subsidy. And an export subsidy can be delivered to the tax system. Mm-hmm. So we lost this notorious case of the EU having to do with the foreign trade company legislation, right? After many, many iterations, we eventually lost it and we had to change our law. But the way it's defined in the WTO law and the subsidies clause is a departure from the normal baseline. So it's all a question of how to define a baseline, and the law is pretty incoherent. That's the general of most trade lawyers, so, but that's another example where it's all about defining a baseline and defining deviation from a baseline, and the Europeans do the same thing in the state aid rules. So there are various contexts in which there's an attempt to define a theoretical baseline and departure from a baseline. And the frustrating thing is that even though it's hard to define theoretically, in many cases, I think you get a pretty broad consensus that something is or is not a departure from the baseline.
Kleinbart's intervention, he was on the Hill.
He was in charge of the tax expenditure budget, so that's how he proposed that.
So that's a budgeting concept.
Yes, and that was always the only practical way in which this whole concept was implemented. And Searle's idea was that once you have a budget, then Congress will not do it anymore. And this relates to what the previous comment says, is that Congress seems not to have been intimidated at all by the fact that these things are quantifiable, because the truth is that voters don't read.
I have a question about your account. I read this book introduction.
It's a symposium.
It's about the South Africa story.
Yeah.
I remember a great moment. It was about 9 years ago when some junior level actors in South Africa were saying, we're not going to play with WIPO. International regime, And the dominoes fell, and the State Department retreated from a pro-drug company position and did an about face and said, let's get the drugs down to South Africa. And so that's this great recursive moment.
Right.
Are there any comparable moments in your experience?
Oh, besides that?
Right. Yeah. When and that's question one. That is, that's a moment that just for me stood out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, when a junior level actor went up against an international juggernaut and just got a result reversed with beneficial effects.
They brought legal cases and they dropped all the legal cases with and got nothing in return.
Did that lead to any changes at WIPO?
WIPO, well, one is that you see a shift back of authority from the WTO to WIPO on intellectual property issues. Now, whether or not, I'm not an expert on WIPO, and WIPO's not much, it's more of the focus is on the WTO and the WHO in this particular paper. But WIPO has changed dramatically. It now has, in developing countries, I mean, WIPO is a strange organization, as you know. It's funded in large part through pharmaceutical industry, and it's a very wealthy international organization because of that. And so it has that legitimacy challenge to it. But at the same time, developing countries become much more assertive within it. It has a real development dimension. Now, what does that development dimension mean? Because often that refers to technical assistance, but technical assistance to provide you with what, right? But I would say that overall, and this is some fascinating, Peter Drell has done some fascinating studies on patent organizations in different developing countries. I mean, the real challenge was that you have sort of these relatively norms subject to interpretation in the WTO documents, which are all being interpreted. They could only mean one thing, which is what the United States says that they mean. And now you have, you know, Brazil has created a completely sui generis system of approving patents where you actually have two agencies, both the Intellectual Property Patent Agency and the health agency have to both give approvals for a patented drug. So that's, you know, something unheard of here, but they take into social considerations. India has remodeled its patent system, which created a lot of political controversy in India. But you now have a patent agency which is making different types of patent decisions than you see taking place here in the PTO in the United States. And they, of course, there's a lot of technical assistance flows from the experts, right, within the United States and European bureaucracies. But and one of the challenges for people in this field in the bottoms-up way is to how to create domestic expertise for domestic purposes to at least play with these norms. But the other thing that is, I think you do find is that in the WTO, you are more constrained in terms of what you do with these legal norms than you are, say, in competition law norms, where it's more open-ended. But in other areas where you see a real backing off, nothing coming to mind right now, but I'm sure that I could think of others, right, where you see things. Well, actually, here's another one from the book, right, which is in, there was a real backlash with respect to the privatization of water services around the world. This ties into the WTO negotiations under the GATS for trade and services. And there's been a reevaluation in the IFIs themselves in terms of what their views are in terms of privatization of water provision, and you have this sort of a human rights discourse which is entering into this field, which simply wasn't there in the 1990s. And the third example, actually, from the book itself is which I mentioned, the World Bank and IMF disavowing that they were ever advocating user fees for primary education once they were called on that in light of human rights norms. So you do, so I think you can see lots of feedback in many different areas of law.
This kind of goes back to the normative, though, because, you know, that you haven't mentioned, for example, the complete and blatant non-recognition of intellectual property rights in China for movies, CDs, books, and various other types of intellectual property?
Well, I mean, normative can cut both ways, right? They have executed people in China as sort of symbolically, but, you know, applied the death penalty to, and they've criminalized, this is a whole area of law which has been criminalized because of the United States and Europe. So whether or not, you know, you should, this should be a, there should be harsh criminal penalties, right, applied for copying CDs is a real normative question.
Well, what I meant is your story is sort of like the heroic country that takes international law and benefits their country in the drug area.
That's not
like
my
that.
Story. Yeah, I do not want to recast it that way.
He's basically thumbing their nose at international law and saying, okay, we won't recognize international law.
China's under a lot of constraints, actually. I mean, certainly they have imperfectly applied, as all laws imperfectly applied, in terms of copyright and patent law. But one, they've invested in patent law. China now is one of the developing countries where they actually are patenting products, and they've invested a huge amount in R&D.
We're almost out of time, and I see one hand, and then Dan, do you have your hand?
Sure.
Yeah. We'll get it here and here.
Yeah, my question goes out to both presenters and maybe to the whole audience. When I saw the title of this panel or this conference, like evolutionary regulations, and I was like fascinating thinking, oh, they are linking regulation theory to evolutionary theories, these economic or social theories. But now, at least I couldn't hear your wrong train, but at least in the discussion, the word evolutionary theory is not really debated. So how you use evolutionary theories and why you
type
evolutionary
theories. Just to jump in with an informational point, the second panel tomorrow is evolutionary perspectives, so I think we're coming there.
Okay.
All right, but it seems to me that what Greg is talking about is a process of how you get there. We're not using the term evolution.
Yeah, I mean, I evolution, to the extent that it applies that we're getting progressively to a better place, right, or a more efficient place, or, you know, the survival of the fitter or the better, I don't use that term. But certainly we're talking about dynamic changes and what are the processes that drive those dynamic changes, which involve public and private, and recursive interaction between transnational lawmaking and national lawmaking. That's what the paper's all about.
We jump in. Dan's been very patient.
No, it's okay. They may be too big of a question, but I mean, they are at the same time being very basic. So the more that you talk, Greg, the more confused I'm feeling about what you mean by international norms. And I mean, it seems like there are so many different kinds of things that you're glomming in, or international law for that matter. It's in the opening, it seemed like you were articulating some sort of positivist status kind of conception of law.
No, anti-positive, right.
Okay, but then it's anti-positivist, but you know, a lot of the things that you're talking about as transnational, for example, what's the transnational normative situation of competition law in relationship to South Africa? South Africa, competition law is domestic rules. They paid attention to what was going on in the world and they made their own rules. Does that count as transnational law?
No.
Okay, so I just, that would be the point for you. And then for Ruben, when you kept saying the regulatory purposes idea, does it boil down to something as simple as if it influences behavior, it's regulatory? Or do you have some other conception of the regulatory? Because it seems like every tax would influence behavior, so it would, you know, the sort of typology breaks down unless you have a stronger definition of the regulatory, but I don't know whether you do. So maybe that's.
I mean, on that one, the question is what the state of the legislator is primarily aiming at, and I think that every tax has side effect. But if the main, I mean, this is just like
so purposes,
static and dynamic revenue scoring. I mean if the main effect is to raise revenue for the government, that's one thing. If the main effect is to achieve distribution, that's another thing, and so on. And everything,
Like but the previous question. The intention might be radically
different.
Yes,
right? That's right.
So
that's right.
Okay. And so for a positivist, right, positivism is much more comfortable talking about state law or international law, because law is really part of the construction of the states. This is
right.
Tax law, so you're funding the states and legitimizing the states, and international law is about mutual recognition between states, right? And so transnational law is not something you can just go teach, right, in a law school either. But so that's the reason why we shift to looking at legal norms that are constructed transnationally, whether by international institutions or public governmental networks or private networks.
Okay.
Now, to give an example, and then we try to give examples of what we're talking about. So in the South African context for competition law, I believe it was the first of the, or what a major meeting, like the World Cup being held in South Africa right now, they hosted the International Competition Network meeting, and that provided huge resources for the for the empowerment of the Competition Law Commission in South Africa. You have, and that created a whole, in terms of profession, the practice of competition law is a booming practice in South Africa. People making a lot of money representing corporations or working in the competition law and sort of creating their professional careers this way. So you see a major shift in terms of a body of law in South Africa, which is South African law, but that South African law doesn't come from nowhere, right? And there are particular actors, conveyors, who are the intermediaries between, who have patterns of interaction between this transnational network called the ICN, International Competition Law Network, and the local actors. They are key players that play in both fields simultaneously, and that empowers their position within the South African context. But it's not a mere sort of internalization and application of, quote, the international norms, but they play within a particular social, historical, political context in South Africa.
Much as I hate to do it, I'm afraid we better call time, not because we don't have more to talk about, but because we've got to have a break before we start over with another panel. Join me in thanking our panelists.